Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section. This is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you Chapter 54 of Sefer Yishayahu. In Chapter 54, we return from the Eved imagery, probably representing the nation of Israel in exile, to the female symbol, Zion, the mother, who certainly represents the city of Jerusalem as well as the congregation of Israel. We've met her before as she longed for her children, and in this chapter, God promises that her time of mourning is at an end, showing her the beauty of her being rebuilt and being repopulated, both as a city and as a nation. Roni akara lo yalada, pitzchiri na, v'tzahali lo chala, Kirabim b'nei shomema mi b'nei ve'ula amar Adonai. Sing in joy, O barren one, one who cannot bear children. Open up in joyful song and rejoice, O one who cannot bear, because the children of the desolate will be greater than the children of the one with husbands. So says the Lord. As Ibn Jikatila says, quoted by Ibn Ezra, the other woman here is Bavel, and this is a dead-on prophecy, since her children were soon to no longer exist at all, that is, the children of Bavel. Ibn Ezra himself, however, leans to this prophecy not only covering the redemption from Babylon, but from the messianic redemption as well, for reasons that we'll see as we continue on. Harchivi mekoma holech viriot mishkanotayich yatu al tachsochi ha'arichi meitarayich vitedotayich chazeki. Broaden the place for your tents, stretch out the cloth for your dwelling places, don't hold back, lengthen your ropes and firm up your tent pegs. Zion is being told to expect a lot of immigrants, a lot of returnees. Does the metaphor mean that there are some in Israel who have already returned home in an early kind of pre-Aliyah, which will soon be joined by a great later Aliyah? This actually matches the description of the two stages of the first Aliyah during Koresh's time, as described in the first two chapters of Ezra. First, the leaders of the people went with the utensils of the temple, and they were led by Sheshbatzar, who was the president of Yehudah, of Judah in exile. Then came a second wave of the general population, led by two people. One is Zerubbabel, who is actually a king from the line of David, although he's never really given the title of king because the Persians wouldn't let him, and Yeshua, the high priest. On the other hand, the metaphor need not be taken so one-to-one that there's sort of a dual-stage aliyah and some people are building for a future greater influx. It may just be God speaking to an abandoned city and a bereaved nation as if she is able to rebuild herself. Ki amin usmol tifroti, because you will burst forth right and left. This may mean burst out of Zion, that is to fill the borders of the city and the land with a great population, and it may be very similar to the prophecy from two chapters ago where there wasn't enough room for all of the returnees to live. They were likened to kids of the woman that simply don't have enough space to live. But I read this verse a little differently. I read this as a three-step historical process. And the first step, which I just read to you, means they will break out not in Zion, but break out of their exile. Then, v'zar'ech goyim yirash ve'arim nishamot yoshivu. Then your offspring will conquer the nations, i.e. the nations living in territorial Israel, who had controlled the land from the time of the Babylonian exile. In fact, some of them had controlled the land going back to the Assyrian exile some 150 years before. And then after the returnees, after the return to Zion, will suppress those locals who are trying to keep them out of their country, they will resettle their desolate cities. Al tir'i kilo tevoshi, va'al tikalami kilo tachbiri, kivoshet alumayach tishkachi, v'cherpat almenutayich lo tizkiri od. Don't fear, since you won't be shamed, and don't feel humiliated, since you won't be disgraced, for the shame of your youth you will forget, and the disgrace of your widowhood you will no longer remember.
The command not to fear, I think, means take a chance, rebuild, and don't let the possibility that it will come to naught and you'll be ashamed of your efforts stop you, since what happened to you before won't happen again. The command or advice not to feel humiliated is a little less clear. How could you, humiliation is part of the process, or what's being promised that you won't have. So how can you both be commanded not to do it and also be promised that it won't come to you? But it seems that in order to get up the courage to return, and remember, this prophecy is only metaphorically speaking to this mother figure in Zion. The actual prophecy is delivered to the children who must make this prophecy come true by following it. They need to overcome both their fear as well as put away their disgrace in order that they'd be successful in returning home and do what needs to be done, which is to rebuild Jerusalem and resettle their homeland. Ki vo alayich osayich Adonai tzvaot shemo v'goalech kedosh Yisrael Elohei chol ha'aretz yikarei. This verse is interesting because there are only verbs of being or passive verbs. There's no action here. Rather, this verse means to establish who the husband is in this metaphor of the bereaved woman, of the woman without a husband. The returning husband is the one who promises to come back to his wife. Because, i.e., the reason why you have no fear for humiliation, is that your husband is your maker. The Lord of hosts is his name. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He will be called the God in every land. That is, everyone will recognize that he is God. That is, he's coming back to you. He is a leader of armies. He makes you holy, and every nation will soon recognize and admit that all that is true. So what's to be afraid of and humiliated about? An important thing to notice here, a little grammatical note, which is quite important, is that bo'alayich is plural, technically your masters or your husbands, not your husband. But osayich, which seems to have the same form, is not plural. It does not mean your makers, plural. The yud is there in osayich because it used to be a hey. The hey from the verb asa becomes a yud when it's conjugated as a noun, much like bana with a hey becomes binyan or banui with a yud. And sadeh, a field, is sometimes sadai, which means not my field, but a field. So bo'alayich is in this form not because it's plural, i.e. multiple husbands, but because it matches osayich, which is in singular. Mm-hmm. And the proof for that is, take a look in the second part of the verse where it says go'alech, your redeemer, and not go'alayich, your plural redeemers. Anyway, getting away from grammar. Kich isha azuva va'azuvat va'atzuvat ruach kira'ach Adonai ve'eshet nurim ki tima'es amar Elohayich. Or I could read it like this. Kich isha azuva va'azuvat ruach kira'ach Adonai ve'eshet nurim ki tima'es amar Elohayich. There are two ways, obviously, to read this verse. One as two rhetorical questions with the assumed answer of no. And it reads like this. Are you an abandoned woman who the Lord calls a sad spirit? The Lord says, can a wife of one's youth really be cast off, literally be found to be disgusting? The answer is no and no. But I think this pasuk is actually a statement of fact, which gives it a negative sense. She is the abandoned woman, a sad spirit, a woman cast off in her youth by God. But the two keys, ki k'isha and ki tima'es, mean that even though it was true, it's now all over as will be described in the next two verses. And now, berega katon azavtich, uvrachamim gdolim akabetzech, v'shetzef ketzef, fistarti fanai rega mimech, v'chesed olamim richamtich, amar goalech Adonai. For a short moment did I leave you, but with great mercy or great love will I gather you up, will I bring you all together. Momentarily I covered my face from you with a downpour of anger, but with an eternal kindness I have loved you, I have taken mercy on you, says your Lord, your Redeemer. Which means, yeah, what was happening in the previous verse was true, but now this is the situation. And what happened to you previously was just a short-term event in order to bring you back with full love. I've translated the very difficult word, the unique word, which is called a hapax logomenon, shetzef, after the Hebrew shetef, which is a downpour. Most Mefarshim do not go that way. However, it really matches the next verse. The idea of a downpour, as you see, will match the next verse. Again, overall, the idea is forget the past and pay attention to the now. And the past is truly a thing of the past, not to return, as God will now explain and promise. Ki me noach zot li, asher nishbati me'avor me noach, od al ha'aretz, ke nishbati mikitzof alayich u'migarbach. Because what happened here is like the waters of Noah, that is, the flood waters, when I swore not to have floodwaters cover the land again, so too do I swear neither to be angry at you now nor to rebuke you again. Ki ha'arim yamushu v'agva'ot timutena v'chasdi me'itech lo yamushu v'rit shlomi lo tamut amar merachamech Adonai. While the mountains may move and hills may topple, my loving kindness, my kindness will not be removed from you, and my covenant of peace will not topple. So says your love, your merciful one, the Lord. There is certainly a hint of messianism here with the earthquake described in many eschatological or end of time prophecies, some of which in fact are in this book. However, in its simplest sense, God is saying that while nature may be unpredictable and capricious, my love and commitment to you, Israel, Zion, is neither. Now, I think that it is these two verses, comparing the return to Zion with the promise never to destroy the earth with floodwaters, that makes most commentaries lean towards a messianic interpretation of this chapter, rather than a prophecy about Babel, since from our perspective, we can't say that nothing that happened during the time of the Babylonian exile wouldn't happen again, because in fact the second temple did fall again, and we found ourselves in another exile, which would make what God said seeming to be untrue. And therefore, many want to say that it's not talking about the Babylonian redemption, but the Messianic redemption, which will be eternal. And this may be true, but one should remember that predictions, prophecies, are always based on compliance with the conditions. I'll give you an example. I could go to the doctor in good health, and he'll say that I'll live to 120. God willing. But if I start up smoking, a smoking habit the minute after I walk out of the doctor's office, well, that changes things. It doesn't mean the doctor was a liar. It just means based on the conditions being described, this would be the outcome. And if you play with those conditions, then the outcome will change to a certain extent. And now God describes a beautiful building process for Zion and the reason why she should never fear, or she will not need to fear, human enemies. Ania, Sora, Lo Nuchama, Hine anochi marbitz bapuch avanaich visadich basapirim. O afflicted one, O storm-tossed one, O uncomforted one, behold, I will pave you with puch stones. I will make your foundation out of sapphires. Puch is probably the same as nofach, one of the stones from the high priest's chest plate, known as the Choshen Mishpat. The ancient Greek translation, which is called the Septuagint, and is the oldest translation of the Bible that we have, dating from 250 BCE, that puts it about 400 years before Uncleus's Aramaic translation, renders Nofach, the stone Nofach, as the stone anthrax, which is a coal. It's not the disease. The disease anthrax is named after the fact that it looks like the stone. Anthrax is some kind of coal or dark red or blackish carbonite stone. Note that the evil Jezebel used puch on her eyes to seduce Yehu, and it didn't work. Yehu had her killed anyway. V'samti kadechod shimshotayich usha'arayich l'avnei ekdach v'chol gvulech l'avnei chefetz. And I will make your shimshotayich, perhaps cornices or buttresses, some kind of out there, very prominent form of beautiful buildings. But the type of stone, kadchod, is unknown. Even the way it's pronounced with three syllables, even though it's a patach under the initial kaf is regular, it should be kadchod, not kadchod. But the Greek translation says jasper, but there's really, you know, no way of knowing for sure what exactly it was. Something pretty, obviously. Getting back, and I make your gates of ekdach stone, probably from the word kadach, or burning or glowing, and the Greek says crystal, which fits very nicely. And I will place precious stones throughout your borders. Now, precious stones here are not used for building material. They just show up through the border. So therefore, I think it starts to hint at the meaning behind the metaphor and refers to the returning people. That is, the stones aren't really stones of which Zion and Israel will be rebuilt, but they are the people who are coming home out of which a real nation is built. The other building elements and stones are no doubt also metaphors for the types of people and the types of revitalization of the city and of the nation, but they also work in the plain sense as a literal adornment of Jerusalem. And in the next super famous verse, the metaphor fades away and the meaning behind the metaphor, that is the children of Israel coming home, is revealed. Of course, this means that we're actually in a metaphor in another metaphor, but that's the tricky nature of poetic prophecy. V'chol banayich limudei Adonai v'rav shalom banayich. And all your children will be disciples of the Lord, and the peace for your children will be greatened. Of course, the double use of banayich is to equate banayich, your sons, with bonayich, your structures. This way, the metaphor and the meaning behind the metaphor appear sort of superimposed in one sentence. Bonayich may also mean peace will be on your builders, the ones who rebuild you, hinting at the problems the builders would run into from the people who don't want Jerusalem and the nation to be rebuilt, those nations who had been living in Israel while Israel was exiled. This intifada against the building process of the returnees of Zion is described in Sefer Ezra and even more so in Sefer Nehemiah, and it is not an unknown phenomenon even today. Bitztakati konani rachaki me'oshek kilo tirai umim mechita kilo tikrav elayich. With righteousness or success, you will be established, or perhaps the opposite, you will establish yourself by being righteous. And distance yourself from oppression, or perhaps oppression will be distance from you. It's hard to say if this is a prediction of success, or if it's a predication, that is, if you set up a just society, and if you avoid oppressing the weak, then you will be established. And in order for you to have no fear, in order, kilo tikra v'ilayach mechita, in order that panic not come back to you, you have to follow a righteous way. And if that verse isn't clear, whether it's a promise or a command to build the right kind of country, the next verse is particularly difficult. Hein gor yagur efes meoti mi gar itach alayich yipol. Perhaps they, the sons of Jerusalem, will have nothing to fear, i.e. no enemies. The word yaguru means to be afraid of war. Only me, God, they must fear. Whoever comes to make fear, i.e. war on you, before you they will fall. Ibn Ezra quotes Ibn Janach as indicating a similar meaning, but with gur meaning that they won't be able to combine against you except on my say-so. So the they of the first part of the pasuk is referring not to the people of Israel have nothing to fear, but that they, the enemies, will not be able to combine against you, referring to the messianic battle of Gog and Magog, which means they won't be able to combine against you except on my say-so, which means for the final battle of Gog and Magog. Ibn Ezra actually prefers the word gur as to live, lagur meaning to dwell or to live, referring back to those other nations that lived in your land. Remember, we were speaking about those enemies, internal enemies, meaning many will try to live with you, but they will only be successful if they accept your rule, alayich, and if they accept my rule, efes meoti. Hinei anochi barati charash nofeach be'esh pecham, ומוציא כלי למעשהו, ואנוכי בראתי משחית לחבל, כל כלי יוצר עלייך לא יצלח. בכל לשון תקום איתך למשפט, תרשיעי. זאת נחלת עבדי אדוני וצדקתם מאיתי מאום אדוני. And now, promising that the enemies will not be able to stop the rebuilding of the nation, the rebuilding of Zion, the verses read, it is I who made the techniques for metalwork, literally the smith for blowing into the coal fire. So it is I who brought forth instruments, who bring forth instruments or weapons for their purpose. And therefore, it is I who make weapons of destruction. Therefore, any instrument or weapon made against you will not succeed. And any complaint brought against you in court, you will defeat. This hints at the legal attempts that the nations of Israel brought, the nations who were living in Israel, the non-Israelite nations living in Israel, who were moved there during Israel's exile, prevent them by writing a Ketav Sitna, a letter to the Persian kings, which is mentioned in Ezra, to try to stop them from rebuilding their nation. And obviously, once again, some things never change. Getting back to the verse, this is the lot, the physical land, the territory of the servants of God, and their righteousness, i.e. their victory against their enemy, comes from me, so says the Lord.